From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the first of a two-part series on what scientists are learning about the brain by studying disorders of the brain. Today we talk about memory and dementia with Dr. Rudolf Tanzi, who has been studying Alzheimer's disease since the early 80s. He's a neurogeneticist who helped identify three of the genes that cause the disease and two that are believed to be related. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of Survivor 2, which has contestants roughing it in the Australian outback. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has created a White House office to help religious organizations compete for federal money for their social service programs. He said it's unfair to deny federal funding to religious groups that are providing effective services for the poor. Critics say the new program violates the constitutional separation of church and state. The president has also announced the formation of an energy task force to be led by Vice President Dick Cheney to look into the California power crisis. Meanwhile, in Sacramento, lawmakers are still working on a deal to keep power flowing in the state. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
California lawmakers are working on two bills. One would basically put the state in the business of buying power on behalf of the financially ailing utilities. Another bill would raise money through revenue bonds in order to help pay off the utility's multi-billion dollar debt. But before the bond plan goes through, lawmakers want to see an audit of the utilities that was performed by the Public Utilities Commission. The audit is reportedly sitting in the governor's office. Wall Street has signaled its optimism with the plan moving through the California State House. Morgan Stanley Dean Witter upgraded the stocks of Pacific Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison from neutral to outperform. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, Sacramento.
President Bush has proposed a $48 billion program that would help low-income seniors pay for prescription drugs. The money would go to states over a four-year period to help Medicare recipients with very low incomes or very high drug expenses. The proposal met with a mixed response from congressional leaders. Democrats want prescription drug coverage for all Medicare recipients, while Republicans say Medicare needs a comprehensive overhaul before drug coverage is included. The Senate has approved Elaine Chao's nomination to be Labor Secretary. Still to come are votes on Gail Norton for Interior Secretary and John Ashcroft to be Attorney General. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Having watched Linda Chavez withdraw, President Bush named Elaine Chao, wife of Senator Mitch McConnell, to the position, and she sailed through the Senate. There has been grumbling about former James Watt protege Gail Norton's nomination to manage the nation's public lands. Republican Larry Craig made light of the complaints from environmentalists, saying they reminded him of an episode of The Honeymooners.
Norton! We kept hearing Norton! We kept hearing. I don't think we've heard that name, Norton, spoken with so much venom since the days of Jackie Gleason.
Bush's most controversial nominee, John Ashcroft, is due for a vote in the Judiciary Committee Tuesday. Two more Democrats, Patrick Leahy and Hillary Clinton, say they'll oppose Ashcroft. Clinton will also oppose Gail Norton, but both are expected to win confirmation. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 42 points today to close at 10,702 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The White House says President Bush will not challenge the pardons issued by his predecessor, former President Clinton. The president did say he was troubled by the pardon given to fugitive billionaire Mark Rich. Rich has been living abroad since his 1983 indictment on charges of evading more than $48 million in taxes. His former wife has donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democratic Party. President Bush said he chose not to challenge the Clinton pardon in order to preserve the privilege for himself and future presidents. At least three protesters were injured today in Jakarta when police fired warning shots and tear gas at thousands of demonstrators who stormed the gates of Indonesia's parliament. The protesters were demanding that President Wahid resign over two corruption scandals. Patricia Noonan reports from Jakarta.
The violence broke out when protesters pushed over a heavy iron gate leading into the grounds of Parliament. When police opened fire with tear gas and warning shots, Some students retaliated by throwing rocks. It was the largest demonstration so far to call for the resignation of President Abdurrahman Wahid, just 15 months into a 5-year term in office. The protest comes as Parliament hears the results of a special investigation into the president's alleged role in 2 financial scandals. The results of the investigation will not be made public until Thursday, when Parliament is expected to announce how it will proceed. President Wahid maintains he has done nothing wrong. He also dismissed calls for his resignation. For NPR News, I'm Patricia Noonan in Jakarta.
In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 57 points, or 2%, to close at 2,838. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from White Wave, the makers of Silk, a lactose-free organic soy milk available in the refrigerated section of supermarkets and natural food stores. Silk is soy.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today and tomorrow, we'll be talking with neurologists who are investigating how the brain works by studying disorders of the brain. Today, we talk about memory and dementia with Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. He's been researching Alzheimer's disease since the early 80s. He's helped identify 3 of the genes that cause Alzheimer's disease and helped identify 2 other genes believed to be related to Alzheimer's. Dr. Tanzi is a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and director of the Massachusetts General Hospital's Genetics and Aging Unit. With his co-author Ann Parson, he has written a new book about the search for the genetic causes of Alzheimer's disease called Decoding Darkness. I asked him what he thinks causes Alzheimer's disease.
Well, I think what we've learned from the genetic findings and identifying the genes involved in this disease over the last decade and a half is that no matter what the gene is, and they're all very different from each other, or most of them are, is that there's a common thread or a common consequence. And that is that as a result of alterations in a variety of different genes, there's an accumulation in the brain of a very sticky, rather nasty substance we call beta amyloid. It's kind of an antiquated term, but we still use it. And this material, as it accumulates, is thought to be toxic to nerve cells and to also cause an inflammatory response in the brain, which is further detrimental to the function of the neural circuitry that creates who we are.
So it kills some brain cells and then prevents living brain cells from communicating with each other?
Yeah, the material is deposited outside of nerve cells, and especially in the areas called the synapses, where the nerve cells make contact with each other. So if you think about your brain as a big neural circuit with billions of connections between nerve cells, this substance starts to accumulate, especially where you make these connections. And so I guess a simplistic way to put it is it can create short circuits in the brain.
Now, there are also tangles in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. It sounds almost like scrambled wires. Why don't you describe what those tangles are?
Well, the tangles are the second lesion you see in the brain of an Alzheimer patient. And in fact, to make a firm diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, one would need to look in the brain and see a requisite number of amyloid as plaques. And inside the nerve cells, you would see these twisted filaments called tangles. They almost look like twisted pretzels. And so if you a nerve cell has a little skeleton of its own that gives it its structure. It's called the cytoskeleton. And the proteins that make up the skeleton of the nerve cell basically get really bungled up and twisted around. And this looks like it's the signature of a dying nerve cell. And the belief right now is that the amyloid comes first, and this material is toxic to the nerve cells. And then as the nerve cells respond to this toxic agent, and they begin to die and, they're becoming dysfunctional, you see along the way in this process that tangles are forming, made up of these proteins that form the skeleton of the nerve cell.
So are medical researchers working now on pharmaceutical drugs that might be able to stop or slow the development of those beta amyloids?
Yes, the answer is yes. And the belief is that the best drugs would be those that strike the disease at its earliest stages, right at the roots of the disease. And the current thinking, and there's plenty of data to support this, is that the amyloid is deposited first. And as the nerve cells react badly to the amyloid, they start to form the tangles. So although you might think, well, we could try to stop the tangles if that's interfering with the nerve cell itself, if you want to get hit earlier than that, really nip the disease in the bud stage, it's better to try to get rid of the amyloid. And so drug companies are thinking there are two ways to do this. And again, it's the genes that have told us how to do this. You can either try to stop the production of the amyloid, or on the other side of the coin, you can try to promote its clearance and its breakdown. And ultimately, I think the real successful treatment for this disease will be, you know, a cocktail, let's say, of drugs that do both, stop production and promote the breakdown and clearance. And luckily, in the pipeline and in clinical trials, there are drugs that do both of these things being tested right now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. He's a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, author of the book Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease. And he's a scientist who's helped identify three of the genes associated with Alzheimer's disease, and he's working on two others believed to be associated with the disease. You have been involved in identifying five genes that are related to Alzheimer's disease. Do they each function in a different way in creating Alzheimer's?
Well, it's interesting. You know, if you look at the genetics of Alzheimer's disease, there's a real polarization in that the genetics is very different for the very early onset cases that strike under 50 or under 60 years old versus those that influence the most common form of the disease that strikes after 60. And I should say, just for the sake of numbers, that about 5% of Alzheimer's can occur under 60 years old and only 1% under 50. The vast majority that occurs after 60 years old. And what we see is that the earlier the disease strikes in life, the more profound and the more robust the role of genetics is. So the first three genes that I was involved with in terms of my studies were all the early onset genes. And what they have in common is that they contain very rare mutations that only account for maybe 1 or 2% of all cases of Alzheimer's. But these mutations can teach us a lot about the disease in general, because when they're inherited, they cause the disease with virtual certainty. In other words, it's almost 100% certain that one will get the disease when they inherit these rare early onset Alzheimer gene mutations, as we call them. In the late onset genes so far, we just see an influence towards susceptibility and increased risk.
What else are you learning about the disease and how it's created by learning about the genes?
It's very interesting. It's amazing how things are falling into place. You know, as we age, all of us are accumulating this material called amyloid in the brain, just like we accumulate cholesterol in our blood vessels. And how much we actually, in the end, accumulate in various regions of the brain depends on production versus clearance and breakdown. It's a formula of balance. So if you produce too much, you're in trouble. That's what the early onset genes. If you break it down too slowly, you're in trouble, and that seems to be the input of the late-onset genes. So from a drug standpoint, you would like to try and lower production the way the early-onset genes have taught us to do, and you'd like to also promote the breakdown and the clearance of the material the way the late-onset Alzheimer's genes are teaching us. So it's really quite a neat formula, and luckily, these drugs are now in clinical trials, and in the last chapter of our book, we actually go into detail about some of the more exciting clinical trials that are being driven by these really wonderful genetic findings that have occurred over the last decade or so.
Now, when you mentioned that everybody starts producing these sticky, nasty beta amyloids, I think I heard a lot of our listeners go, oh, no, because so many people, particularly people in their 40s and up, fear that they're losing their memory, that they can't remember things as well as they used to. And they worry, is this like early onset of Alzheimer's disease? If you're feeling like you're not remembering things the way you once did, or words aren't appearing in your mind the way they once did, does this mean that you have beta amyloids building up in your brain?
It's an excellent question. And I think the best way to answer that is to suggest, for simplicity, three different types of memory problem. First is just forgetfulness that comes with age. This probably has nothing to do with amyloid or tangles or anything we see in Alzheimer's. Remember, the brain is a neural circuit. It's connections, billions of connections between, you know, billions of nerve cells. And just like, you know, a piece of electronic equipment, with age, that circuitry begins to deteriorate a bit. And forgetfulness can occur naturally. On the other hand, all of us as we age, and especially after 40, are starting to accumulate some of these lesions you see in Alzheimer's. They are a fact of life, the amyloid plaques and the tangles you see inside the nerve cells. But these lesions have to reach a certain level before they start to threaten your actual quality of life, where loss of memory and cognitive decline starts to threaten your everyday functioning. At that point, you get into the second level of memory loss, which we call mild cognitive impairment, or MCI. And this can go either way. It can be, you know, just a very severe case of forgetfulness that comes with age and never proceed to Alzheimer's. But certain cases of MCI can also proceed to full-blown Alzheimer's. And when you do see full-blown Alzheimer's, as, you know, determined by cognitive testing or in some cases helped by imaging studies of the brain, at this point, the lesions involving amyloid and tangles have reached such a tremendous level in areas of the brain involved with learning and memory and association that now they threaten quality of life and everyday functioning of the brain. At this point, you can say it's now in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. But the bottom line is, for just forgetfulness that occurs after 40 years old, do not panic that it's Alzheimer's disease. It's natural.
My guest is Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. He's been researching the genetic causes of Alzheimer's disease since the early 80s. He's the co-author of the new book, Decoding Darkness. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. He's a professor of neurology at the Harvard Medical School and the author of the new book, Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease. He's a scientist who has helped identify three of the genes associated with Alzheimer's disease and is working on two others believed to be associated with the disease. Dr. Tanzi, what are your thoughts on genetic testing now? Do you feel that someone who has reason to believe that they might be prone to Alzheimer's disease should get the genetic testing?
Well, right now, there really is no feasible way to do reliable genetic testing for the most common form of Alzheimer's that strikes after 60 years old. For the early onset genes that we and others have identified that carry mutations causing the disease under 60, it's possible to do testing. And that's only about 1 to 2% of cases. So it's not very applicable to the disease in general. But for the late onset, you know, common form of this disease that accounts for, you know, greater than 95% of cases, we don't have a reliable gene test yet. I do believe that the current research is moving at such a frenetic pace that we will have a whole set of genes that are confirmed for late onset beyond the one that's most established already, so that we can combine those genes together into a test to assess one's overall risk for getting the disease at a certain age. But caveats come to mind. For example, is it worth doing this type of test if there's nothing you can do about the disease, that there's no drug out there once a positive outcome is found? What about the family of the patient? They're going to worry quite a bit if a family member carries these genes. They'll worry about their own well-being, and again, you're going to want to offer some form of prevention for them. And I think one of the most important aspects to bring up is protection against discrimination according to one's own genome. You know, right now we're making strides toward genetic privacy and protecting individuals against genetic discrimination, but we're not there yet. And I think we really have to have a very firm stand in this country and other countries to say that no one can be discriminated against by health insurance companies, employers, or otherwise simply because of the DNA in their genome. And until we reach that stage, we're going to be very careful with genetic testing. And it's important to do that because in the future, treatment of diseases like Alzheimer's and other diseases that are age-related, like cancer and diabetes and heart disease, are going to require early prevention. You need to really attack diseases at their root stages before they take hold. And that means early prediction using genetics and then early prevention. We can't do that until protection against discrimination is firmly established in our government and our medical systems.
If you have a parent or a grandparent who has had Alzheimer's disease, does that necessarily mean that you're more likely to get it?
Well, it's again, there's a spectrum there for early versus late onset disease. If one has a parent or a grandparent who got Alzheimer's disease under 50 years old, and that's pretty rare, the genetic component is pretty strong. Unfortunately, there is reason to be concerned, because if a parent had one of these causative mutations that we've seen in the early onset genes, there's a 50-50 chance of passing it down to the children. And that's certainly a concern for cases that occur under 50. Under 60, or let's say between 50 and 60, you enter a gray area where it could be this very strong genetic component with a 50-50 chance of causation, or it could tend toward the late onset Alzheimer's situation, in which, you know, for the vast majority of the cases that occur in the 70s or 80s, genetics plays a role, but it's just susceptibility. There, even if you inherit the gene or genes from a parent that caused their risk for Alzheimer's, it's not a given. It's certainly not a guarantee you're going to get the disease. So it really is quite different for one's situation if they have a family member with early onset Alzheimer's disease, especially under 50, versus common garden variety Alzheimer's, so to speak, that strikes in the 70s or 80s or later.
Are there things you are learning about memory and how memory functions from studying Alzheimer's?
You know, when I first started studying Alzheimer's back in the 80s, I thought that was going to be the case. I thought that the genes we'd come up with and the biological pathways we would see would be directly involved with, you know, the secrets to memory, you know. But surprisingly, I'd have to say so far that hasn't really been the case. Most of the genes that have come up, and even the genes that continue to crop up, really affect more the rate of accumulation of amyloid in the brain, just this toxic invader that's made by nerve cells and accumulates outside of the nerve cells and attacks the neural circuitry. We have not yet seen, so far from genetics, genes that, you know, delve into the mysteries of memory affecting this disease. It looks more like a pretty direct attack of a nasty substance, what we call amyloid.
Why is it then that most people who have forms of dementia seem to lose their long-term memory last and their short-term memory first?
Well, because it looks like in the earliest stages of the disease, the parts of the brain that are involved with registering short-term memory, areas of the brain like the hippocampus, coming from the Latin for seahorse, because it's a little area of the brain that looks like a seahorse. And there's another area that feeds the hippocampus information. So as your sensory organs, you know, take in information, your eyes, your ears, your nose, it goes through another area called the entorhinal cortex. And that's like a little transfer station that then sends that information to the hippocampus and says, okay, you know, you just smelled an apple. Register that in the hippocampus as memory. Well, that connection between the entorhinal cortex and the hippocampus seems to get severed very early in the disease. This was one of the early findings in the mid-80s. And the reason for that is not exactly clear, but we do know that the pathological lesions, the amyloid and the tangles, do seem to concentrate in these areas of the brain, like the hippocampus, like the entorhinal cortex, that's directly involved with short-term memory in registering sensory information that comes in on a minute-to-minute basis.
You explained a bit about why short-term memory is usually the first thing to go with Alzheimer's disease. Is there more of a progression that you usually see?
Well, it begins with short-term memory, and eventually as, you know, various parts of the brain begin to get affected, Alzheimer's will eventually affect long-term memory, and then eventually could even affect parts of the brain involved with movement. So you'll sometimes see in a very late stages, Parkinson's-like symptoms as well. So it progresses out from short-term to long-term to even movement types of problems in the patient. But I think, you know, in terms of thinking about drugs, we have to concentrate on where the genes tell us to concentrate, and that is that the earliest stages of this disease are in the areas of the brain more involved with short-term memory, you know, minute-to-minute associations. And if we can, you know, nip the disease in the bud stage by not letting the lesions occur in these various early regions of the brain that are affected, if we use genes to guide us on how to do that, you know, I'm very optimistic that we will have drugs within, let's say, 5 to 10 years, which will be effective. The development of these drugs is converging in parallel very nicely with our understanding of the genetics and our identification of the genes involved with the disease. Most importantly, the genes involved with the most common late onset forms of Alzheimer's that strike in the 70s or 80s. So eventually what we would hope to have is a genetic test that can be performed confidentially and with protection, with proper counseling, genetic counseling, psychological counseling for the patient and families, and then combine that genetic testing with prescribing just the right cocktail of drugs that's best for that individual based on their own genome. That includes drugs that would be the safest in those individuals, again, based on what the genome testing tells the doctor.
Dr. Rudolf Tanzi is the co-author of Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease. He's a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Tapes and transcripts of most Fresh Air programs are available by calling 877-21-FRESH or 877-213-7374. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about the causes of Alzheimer's disease with Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. After studying the disease for years, his own grandmother developed Alzheimer's. Also, David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of Survivor 2. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. He's been researching the genetic causes of Alzheimer's disease since the early 80s. He helped identify three of the genes that cause the disease and two others believed to be related. He's the co-author of the new book, Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease. Dr. Tanzi is a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and director of the Massachusetts General Hospital's Genetics and Aging Unit. Dr. Tanzi, during the course of your research, your grandmother developed Alzheimer's disease. Are there things that you started to understand about the disease on a different level from actually seeing her?
In the case of my grandmother, it's very interesting because we need to consider the risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, in which the number one risk factor is age, number two is family history, and that's where the genetics comes into play, number three is gender. Women do get it more than men, even after, you know, correcting for the fact that women live longer than men. And number four is head trauma. And I think that one was most pertinent to my grandmother because she had quite a fall early in life when she was in her 50s, in which she banged up her head quite badly and needed stitches. And, you know, one thought is that you have really an interplay between genetics and environment for many age-related disorders, whether they be Alzheimer's or heart disease or diabetes. So in my grandmother's case, I think what might have happened is that she was genetically predisposed to the disease and may have escaped it, you know, but the disease could have been triggered by the head trauma, you know, quite severe head trauma that she suffered when she was in her 50s. So it taught me that, you know, it's really important in the future to also identify more of the factors of life exposure and environment, in addition to genetic factors, all of which can conspire to cause risk for the disease. On the more personal level, I would say that it was absolutely terrifying to see that the changes in my grandmother were not typical for Alzheimer's. It wasn't simply memory loss, and this may have to do with the fact that it started with head trauma. But she went from being a very sweet, kind, generous, you know, elderly woman who, you know, made me homemade pasta and held me in her lap when I was a kid, to being quite scared, aggressive, paranoid. I mean, it was a different person. She didn't just lose her memory, lose herself. Her personality dramatically changed into someone who, you know, I had no idea who she was anymore.
Have you come across that much in people who didn't suffer severe head trauma before the onset of Alzheimer's? That kind of personality change?
Well, it's interesting because in Alzheimer's, you know, the personality change can occur, but usually it's out of frustration because of memory loss and just, you know, not being able to find the right words. There is, however, another form of dementia that I think is underappreciated, that is not Alzheimer's disease, but we call it FTD, for frontal temporal dementia. And in this other form of dementia, and, you know, one form of frontal temporal dementia, for example, is Pick's disease, and which people may have heard of. You can also get dementia with Parkinson's symptoms due to these mutations. And in this case, some of the earliest signs are not necessarily, you know, memory loss, but severe personality change. And it is quite a different disease, although the pathology is shared with Alzheimer's with regard to tangles, at least in a percentage of the cases.
Now, I know most of your research is in the laboratory, but do you do research with people who actually have Alzheimer's disease, research in observing them or doing any medical research with them?
Well, you know, I run a lab, actually a research unit, where we do experiments in the realm of molecular biology, cell biology, biochemistry. But I am performing genetic studies on, you know, well over 500 or 600 families for the purposes of observing the patients and following the course of their disease or following siblings to see who, you know, that may be at risk. I have very good collaborators who do that type of testing and do the clinical assessment outside of my laboratory, and then keep that information actually, you know, in many cases blinded from me because, you know, I provide, you know, the genetic data and in true scientific fashion, we try to do this as blindly as possible. Also for confidentiality, you know, I prefer not to know the names of the families I'm working on, and for their protection as well. You know, I don't want to, you know, be in any situation where I have to, you know, suddenly give out their genetic information. So we keep the clinical assessment side separate and blinded from the genetic testing side for a variety of reasons.
Now, you didn't initially set out to study Alzheimer's disease. You were studying Huntington's disease and Down syndrome. How did that lead you to Alzheimer's?
Well, in the early 80s, I was just really lucky. Out of college, I hooked up with Professor Gasella, Jim Gasella. At the time, I was 21, he was 26. And there was no human genome yet. There was a human genome. There was no human genome project yet. There were very few genes known. And Jim Gasella had this idea that, hey, you know, you could go in and try to find the gene responsible for a disease simply and only using genetics without having to really know anything about what goes wrong in the brain in that disease, just the power of genetics to get you there. And many people thought this was crazy. And we were very lucky because Jim's idea worked out. And in fact, the Huntington's disease gene, when it was localized in the early 80s, was really the first disease gene to be found where we had no prior ideas about the chromosome involved or the proteins involved or anything like that. Just straight genetics looking at the families and testing, you know, markers inside of the genome, DNA markers as we call them. Around the same time, muscular dystrophy was being worked on. But there they already knew, based on the sex-linked nature of that disease with males versus females, that it was probably on the X chromosome. But the first disease gene to be found where it could have been anywhere in the genome using only genetics was Huntington's. And, you know, I was the hands at the bench, you know, for Jim that did the work. And it was a great way to be introduced into a revolutionary field. So I decided, while working with Jim and about to become a graduate student in neurobiology at Harvard, that in anticipation of that I wanted to try to build a map of a chromosome, you know, kind of a pre, you know, Human Genome Project chromosomal map. And I chose the smallest one. Frankly, I thought I could finish it fastest if it was the smallest chromosome. And the smallest chromosome is number 21. And that's the one that's involved in Down syndrome, where Down syndrome patients have an extra copy of that chromosome in every cell. And when I had learned, and I should say others had learned as well, that Down syndrome patients, when they reach middle age, start to accumulate a vast amount of the Alzheimer pathology that you see in Alzheimer patients, I and other labs as well speculated that there may be an Alzheimer's gene on chromosome number 21. And I was in a very lucky position because I was sitting there with the genetic map of chromosome 21 that I had helped to construct. So I really landed into Alzheimer's by picking the right chromosome to work on in a very early, you know, pre-Human Genome Project era, small project in Jim Gasella's lab. And then once I started on Alzheimer's and things started to work out, I never looked back.
My guest is Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. He's been researching the genetic causes of Alzheimer's disease since the early 80s. He's the co-author of the new book, Decoding Darkness. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Rudolf Tanzi. He's a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and author of the new book, Decoding Darkness, The Search for the Genetic Causes of Alzheimer's Disease. He's a scientist who has helped discover three of the genes that are involved in Alzheimer's disease, and he's discovered two of the other genes believed to be associated with Alzheimer's. I'm going to ask you to look ahead a little bit for us. If you look ahead, say, 10 or 20 years, optimistically, but not in too phony a way, what are some of the possibilities you see for the prevention or treatment of Alzheimer's?
I think there's a very good chance, and I must say that I'm very optimistic about this, that 5 to 10 years from now, and I don't know if it's 5 years, maybe it will be 10 years, but sometime over the next decade, we will see a real masterful convergence of drug development. And I think the amyloid hypothesis is going to win. I think it will be drugs that curb the production of amyloid and help break it down in the brain. These will be developed, coming out of clinical trials, ready to go. At the same time, we're going to have probably anywhere from 5, maybe more, maybe 5 to 10, both major and minor genes that influence the risk for Alzheimer's disease. And one can be tested around, let's say, 40 years old for their overall risk for the disease. And again, assuming this can be done legally and confidentially without discrimination. And that gene profile will then allow a physician to guide this person into a preventative treatment for the disease based on what their own genome tells the doctor. So now we enter into a bit of a quagmire, because one must ask, well, geez, you know, all of us, this is a common age-related disorder. I mean, Alzheimer's is striking up to 40% of individuals over 85 years old. Can HMOs and can health insurance afford to give everyone preventative treatment with potentially expensive drugs starting at 40 years old and assuming that they might be on those drugs for 40 or 50 years? You know, who is eligible, who is not? So there we're going to get into a real gray area of, when does the genetic profile say that preventative treatment is justified starting at an early age? Now, I'm looking, you know, years ahead here, but I think we're going to see great debates 5 or 10 years from now about just when genetics justifies that a health insurance company should pay for a potentially expensive drug for decades of treatment to prevent an age-related disorder. And this isn't only for Alzheimer's. We're going to see this for all of the major health-related, age-related diseases, from Alzheimer's to heart disease to diabetes to various forms of cancer.
Your grandmother had Alzheimer's disease. Do you worry about getting it yourself? Do you want to get yourself genetically tested, even though there's really nothing you could do about it if you found that you were genetically prone to it?
I decided that over the next decade, when genetic testing is reliable, when I emphasize it is not at all reliable right now for the most common form of this disease, that when reliable testing is available, if there are drugs, even one drug, that can help lower the chances of the disease taking root and help prevent the disease, yes, I would want the test, and I would like to get on that drug, and I would, you know, pray that my health insurance covers such a drug given my genetic profile. But I would not want to be tested personally until there was a drug available to do something about it. Now, everybody is different. I mean, everybody, you know, is going to have to make their own choice. Some people might want to know, even if there's nothing you can do about it. It's a very personal decision.
What kind of medications, if any, are available now for people with Alzheimer's?
Right now, there's a class of drug that's called the cholinesterase inhibitor. So what is that? Well, one of the chemicals in your brain, a neurochemical, that is needed for learning and memory and association, is a chemical called acetylcholine. It's a neurotransmitter. One nerve cell sends it to another nerve cell as a chemical to say, here's a signal, here's a message for a memory, for an association. It ends up that in Alzheimer's disease, although many different nerve cells are attacked, many different neurotransmitters and neurochemicals are depleted. One in particular that we really need for memory is acetylcholine. So it was decided, you know, long ago, based on those findings that started in the 70s, maybe we should try to preserve the amount of acetylcholine in the brains of patients. Now, what breaks down that neurotransmitter is a certain enzyme, and the class of drug that's out there right now is one that tries to inhibit that enzyme from breaking down acetylcholine, so you have more of this neurotransmitter around, you know, for when you need it for learning and memory. So you basically try to preserve the neurotransmitter by preventing its breakdown. The drugs that do this, two of the best examples are Aricept and Exelon. And I think both of them work, you know, pretty much comparably. Problem is, you know, they only treat a symptom. They're treating a memory symptom. They're not getting to the roots of the disease. They're not stopping the amyloid. They're not getting rid of the tangles. And another problem is that even with a positive effect of these drugs, sometimes the effect can wear off after a few months and the patient is back to square one. But, you know, they're better than nothing. And at least there's something out there that one can take and have a bit of hope, even though, as I think about it, you know, they amount to a Band-Aid on a pretty gaping wound. The other treatment is simply vitamin E, because as things start to go downhill in the brain and amyloid accumulates and nerve cells are lost, there's what's called an inflammatory response in the brain, and free radicals are produced. And these little, you know, they're like little tiny bullets that are made in the brain as part of an inflammation response. And so these free radicals, even though the brain is making them deliberately because they think they have to kill something off that's attacking the brain. For example, if you've got bacterial meningitis, the way the brain kills that bacteria in the brain is an inflammation, and free radicals are made like little bullets to kill the bacteria. But in this case, there's no bacteria. There's amyloid and there's dying nerve cells. So these free radicals can ironically turn on the brain with friendly fire and kill even more nerve cells than what were originally attacked. So you want to try to curb that inflammatory response a bit. So aspirin and ibuprofen have been proposed as potentially useful. And there again, you have to worry about, you know, GI tract complications, you know, ulcers, that type of thing. And vitamin E, which is an antioxidant, has been proposed because it can help reduce the number of free radicals in the brain. And it appears that there are trials going on right now for the combination of vitamin E plus Aricept or Exelon. And, you know, the thought is that the combination is probably a good idea for now, given that we really have nothing else. There are also trials looking at anti-inflammatory drugs. And so that's really all we have right now.
So many people I know feel that they want to find a certain word and they just can't find the name for something they're looking for, the name of the thing they're looking for. Or they just kind of forget what it is they were going to say. You're just like absent-mindedness. Do those sound like serious symptoms to you, or like typical signs of getting a little bit older?
It really depends on how often that happens and whether it's starting to severely affect your own quality of life and your own everyday activities at your job or at home. I'm 42. And I forget all the time, you know, why I went into the living room or why, you know, I left my office to go into the lab. And, you know, I forget words. I forget names. It's natural. It comes with age. It happens especially after 40 years old. There's nothing you can do about it. But if it starts becoming so severe that every 5 minutes there's a word you can't remember, a name you can't remember, you're constantly forgetting, you know, why you got up out of your seat to go into the kitchen. It's really frequency. If it happens very, very often to the point that you're becoming frustrated and saying, geez, I can't live a normal life anymore, then it's time to see the doctor. Otherwise, I think the rule is, you know, not to panic and not to assume for the worst.
One last question. It sounds to me that you must be pretty constantly excited by the work that you're doing.
I'm overwhelmingly excited about the work I'm doing. I have to say that, you know, in Decoding Darkness, what we try to celebrate is an incredible chapter in the history of medical research, where 20 years ago, we really knew nothing about this disease except these lesions that accumulate in the brain that Dr. Alzheimer himself saw in a patient in 1906. For the entire century, we went on just knowing that when you look at the brain of an Alzheimer patient after autopsy, you see these lesions. Trying to figure out the disease before the age of genetics was like going to Foxborough Stadium. I mean, I'm a Patriots fan despite their season. And trying to figure out the game of football, you know, 2 hours after the game ended. You know, looking at the stands and the litter and the dug-up dirt. Maybe you might find a page torn out of the playbook or a Gatorade cup, but you're not going to understand a game of football. But the work of really, you know, hundreds if not thousands of labs around the world, dedicated researchers, have really in 20 years turned this around, and that we've been able to identify the genes, and from there identify what goes wrong with them, which biological pathways are being abnormally altered, and now the ideas for where to target drugs come around. And so I think it's really one of the most, if not the most exciting fields of medical research to be in today.
Well, Dr. Tansey, thank you so much for sharing some of your research with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Dr. Rudolf Tansey is the co-author of Decoding Darkness. He's a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Tomorrow, we meet a neurologist who is studying brain disorders to learn how the brain creates a sense of self. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Survivor 2. This is Fresh Air. Last night, after the Super Bowl ended, CBS presented the first installment of its sequel to Survivor, last season's smash hit series. Its regular spot will be Thursdays, opposite NBC's sitcom Friends. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Was CBS smart to schedule Survivor after Super Bowl 35? Let me answer that question by asking another. This morning, at the office or at home, what were you talking about the most? Was it that thrilling final quarter of Super Bowl 35? Or all those spectacular commercials, most of which faded from memory as soon as they faded to black? Or was it Survivor, the Australian outback, with its granite waterfall, its vomit bags, and its bug-infested figs? That's what I thought. Any doubts about whether this new Survivor would match its South Seas predecessor in terms of personality conflicts and breathtaking scenery were erased almost instantly. Last time, the show's premise, the rules, and the true strategic importance of the immunity challenges were brand new. This time, the audience, like the more buff contestants this time around, know exactly what to expect and what is at stake. It's still 16 people competing and scheming to be the last one playing the game and grab that million-dollar prize. It still begins with the contestants divided into two tribes of eight, competing against one another for goodies, like waterproof matches, and for immunity, which means the other tribe has to throw someone out of the outback. In this new Survivor series, the two tribes are called the Kucha and the Okagor. The Okagor won the challenge last night, but the Kucha had all the best TV moments. Jeff got sick and threw up early, just like Ramona had in the original Survivor. Last time, Rudy, Rich, and Bebe were the most irritating people out of the gate. In Australia, the early irritants were all Kuchas. There was Mike, the pushy leader when it came to building a shelter. And Deb, an equally vocal corrections officer who was the first to be voted off, making her this year's Sonia. And finally, there was Kimmy, the loudest and most abrasive person caught by the Survivor night vision cameras the tribe's first evening in their cramped little shelter. The next morning, Deb and Jeff had something to say about her.
You gotta share something about yourself that's really embarrassing.
Okay. Embarrassing?
I just got naked in a tent with a bunch of strangers.
That's what I was getting ready to say.
Give us the dirt.
Like boyfriend, husband, wife.
Okay, you know, A, not girlfriend. Married. Don't believe in marriage until I'm 35.
Okay, don't say you're a virgin, because I swear to God, people talk about
the My main concern was, where the hell am I going to masturbate out here?
That's the bad thing.
You have got to be kidding me.
Kimmy is a happy-go-lucky person who's got, I don't even know how to describe her. I don't know what the right word is. You know, nothing is taboo with her. Nothing at all.
Listen to me. You guys might like a skin wig, however, on occasion.
Kimmy will not shut up. You know, I'm tired at night, I want to go to sleep, and they're constantly talking, and with the headache that I have, it just reverberates. Kimmy cannot say a single thing without screaming it.
All right, someone just stuck their finger in my...
was on my head.
All of a sudden, out of the blue, with that accent, it just talks and talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. I just want to grab her by the neck and shake the out of her, you know?
Oh, my God, I love you.
Host Jeff Probst, handling the first tribal council, seemed to be having fun from the start, even if the contestants didn't. As for the scenery this time, it was beautiful. The overwhelmingly clear night sky, the granite waterfall on which the tribal councils are held, and the riverside camp settings are all major pluses. Last night's premiere even had one of those wonderful survivor surprises. A bite into a wild fig resulted in the discovery not of an exotic Australian delicacy, but of a fruit fully infested with tiny bugs. This survivor, like the last one, is shaped and presented like a true mystery story. It's the production values, editing, and character development that make it so appealing. It also promises an ultimate, finite conclusion, making it very unusual in TV dramatic terms. Survivor, in a way, is the modern equivalent of those sweeping miniseries we used to flock to 20 and 25 years ago. We end up caring about these characters, but not all of them make it to the end. And unlike weekly TV dramas that seem to go on forever, there is an end to Survivor. In terms of network competition, though, this is only the beginning. In 3 days, Survivor goes up against Friends, and NBC is taking that threat so seriously that the network is countering by adding 10 minutes to Friends, at least for the first few weeks, and presenting special live mini-installments of Saturday Night Live. The Friends expansion, that's no big deal. If NBC had a better comedy than The Weber Show after Friends, it'd probably stand pat. The Saturday Night Live move is much smarter. It'll promote the late-night show in primetime and, like Survivor, offer something that people are likely to talk about the next morning. But what Survivor has, as its whole card, is momentum. Each show becomes more dramatic and more important as the contestant pool is pared down. Last season, the audience levels kept growing, and the climax of the South Seas Survivor was one of last season's most popular TV programs, second only to the Super Bowl. Now answer these last two questions as quickly as you can. Number one, who won last year's Super Bowl? Time's up. Now here's question number two. Who won last year's Survivor? I rest my case. Trust me, folks, no matter what NBC or any other network throws against it, Survivor isn't going anywhere for a while.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Strong Women Stay Young by Dr. Miriam Nelson, which describes her strength training program for women. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what studying brain disorders can tell us about how the brain creates a sense of self and where the sense of self is located in the brain. Our two-part series on the brain continues with psychiatrist and neurologist Dr. Todd Feinberg, author of Altered Egos. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.